to Wait What? The history quiz where we laugh at the past to keep from weeping about the present. I'm your host, Phil Ahrensberg. I'm a history nerd with a passion for exploring the weirder side of the human story. I'm joined today by a panel as erudite as they are entertaining. Let's meet them now. First off, we have improviser and dad, it's Mike Burson. Thanks for joining us today, Mike. How's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to this for about a week or so.
Excellent. Well, glad to have you here. Next, she's a professor of literature and film at the University of Albany. Please welcome to the panel teacher and writer Mary Valentis. Hi, Mary. How's it going?
It's going really well. How are you doing?
I'm good. You know, the death of the Enlightenment and the fall of the Republic notwithstanding, everything is going pretty well here. And then finally, she's author, educator, and in the best way, shitster. Welcome back to the panel, Heather Walbert-Garin. Hey, Heather, how's it going?
Hey, well, it's going. I'm hanging in there like the cat poster, right?
Nice. All right, excellent. Everyone's done this before, so for our new listeners, the format around here is pretty simple. I'll describe some strange event or person from history and ask the panel questions about it. Points are awarded based on how much I like those answers, and the person with the highest score at the end wins. Our panel will be competing, as always, for bragging rights and a box of Cap'n Crunch cereal. This week's topic, everybody's freaking out. Occurrences of weird collective behavior have been happening since people were people. There have been endless sources cited for these crowd-sized spasms of collective weirdness. Biological reactions, chemical reactions, psychology, supernatural intervention. Today, we're looking, panel, at instances of collective delusions and mass hysteria.
All right.
Yes.
Excellent.
Cool. Got my pulse on, got my finger on the pulse of today's topics here. I'm sure that'll stay in. All right, well, let's take a look at the two things we're looking at here, mass hysteria and collective delusions. Now, each one of these things has some specific characterizations that make them different from each other. For 1 point each, let's see how many you can name. Let's start with mass hysteria. Heather, what constitutes mass hysteria?
Oh, gosh, it's like that riot mentality, you know, that kind of makes those people just cross the red line and those around them approve of it. And there's a rationale to it. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm getting confused between the two, but you took me right back to like fifth grade reading groups with like Tituba, whatever that book was, about the Salem witch trials. You know, like that kind of mass hysteria, like that group hive craziness.
Okay. Mike, what do you got for mass hysteria?
The first thing that popped into my head was Y2K. And people were going completely, you know, apeshit or anything, but it definitely, you know, I remember I was living in LA. We were going to a New Year's Eve party and we all went out into the middle of the street when it hit midnight just to see if all the lights would shut off. So, and they didn't for some reason. Yeah, I think a lot of it these days is fed by the media that, you know, they just want to go with it because it's a story that, you know, people glom onto.
All right. And then Mary, how about you?
I would say people get hysterical and panicked and crazy if they hear a weather report these days, because I think the weather people are, you know, they hype up something. You know, there's 1 inch of snow or something like that. And everybody rushes to the grocery store and they think they're going to starve because there's going to be one day of snow or rain or something like that. So they clear all the shelves. And I don't know what they do with all the food. But I think that is a kind of mass hysteria. I mean, there are other kinds of mass hysteria, but I think this is very common right now.
Well, very interesting points, panel. So Heather was the only one who correctly identified a symptom of mass hysteria. Mary and Mike, you both brought up instances of collective delusion.
Well, so that's a point. Difference. Educate us, Phil.
I will. So mass hysteria typically involves physical symptoms, fainting, nausea, dizziness, some sort of central hallucination. It's usually triggered by anxiety, stress, or fear. It typically affects tightly connected groups, right? So the small town of Salem or 12 Angry Men, you know, some or a school or some small population.
Sure.
Symptoms are real to those affected, but there's no medical corresponding cause for them. And it spreads rapidly through social contagion. And that's where Mike and Mary had it wrong. So things like media and, you know, media spread hysteria, that's a collective delusion.
Oh.
Social contagion is if you see someone doing it, you do it yourself.
What
but
about,
it's that
like,
first chance.
Okay. What about those like religious examples, like the you are healed, like that kind of situation? Like, what does that qualify?
That's more the power of suggestion, because that's down to an individual.
What about then, a cult leader? I mean, is that part of collective something?
That's more a collective delusion. So a collective delusion involves beliefs or perceptions, not physical symptoms. Right? Someone who becomes paralyzed is hysterical. But someone who, you know, gives all their money to a cult was probably delusional or at least misguided. Often it centers on superstitions, conspiracies, and panic. And it's not necessarily triggered by stress. It's more triggered from cultural or social influences. And it usually involves a false attribution of events. So blaming something on supernatural forces or government conspiracies. So, it, you know, it's almost the more public version of mass hysteria.
Would the QAnon situation be an example of that?
Yeah, that's a conspiracy. So let's take a look at some examples of mass hysteria. Oh, and by the way, I should say at the end of that quick question round, Heather has 1 point, Mary has negative one, and Mike has negative 2 points.
Yes!
We'll start off with mass hysteria. Specifically, dancing mania. This is defined as a medieval phenomenon where groups of people would dance uncontrollably, often for extended periods of time, sometimes until exhaustion or death. The most notorious of these episodes was the Great Dancing Plague of 1518, occurring in Strasbourg from July to September of that year. Numerous sources recorded that up to 400 people compulsively danced for weeks. Has anyone heard of this?
Have not.
No, but it reminds me of those 1950s, like those 1950s
dance marathons.
Yeah, where you would see pictures of people like just collapse on each other and still doing the jive, you know, the Philly or something.
I thought of a Porky Pig cartoon where
he's right, the red shoes, right?
It's called The Wearing of the Grin. It was these two leprechauns gave him these magic shoes that constantly danced and he couldn't
right
stop.
I mean, it feels like some sort of like Celtic, you know, fairy tale or something.
Like Hans Christian Andersen, right? Wasn't he the author of the red shoes initially?
No, no, well, I maybe think, I'm thinking of a different story.
Thank you, Mary.
Yeah.
So the outbreak in Strasbourg began when a young woman known as Frau Trofea began to dance fervently and uncontrollably in a street. According to a neighbor, Frau Trofea had started dancing on July 14th in a narrow cobbled street outside her half-timbered home. As far as we can tell, she had no musical accompaniment, but simply began to dance. Some of those who witnessed her strange performance had begun to mimic her, and within days, more than 30 choreomaniacs were in motion. This is a word that was coined at the time, choreomaniacs, because this was so common. Why, panel, for points, why dancing? Let's start off with you, Mary.
I think I just written about people who dance and actually they dance till they die. Do you know anything about that phenomenon where somebody will, this whole group will dance till they die, till one person dies? And what? I think there's something involved in a weird kind of death wish and negative excitement to see how long somebody can, you know, endure something. I mean, it's like the people who eat hot dogs, you know, how many hot dogs can people eat? And it's about going to a place that is so treacherous in some way. It's kind of dangerous, and there's a kind of negative excitement about it. Can you think of other examples where that happens? I mean, dancing is such a physical kind of a thing. It's a kind of hysteria for some people. I remember American Bandstand.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I think about the life of a peasant in 1518, you know, is pretty much labor and praying and, you know, a few saints holidays throughout the calendar year. And maybe a little bit of dancing. So maybe there's something transgressive about the act of dancing.
In terms of sexuality or?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think it was necessarily lewd dancing, but I don't know. Heather, any theories?
That kind of reminds me of that TED Talk, How to Start a Movement. Do you know what I mean? And I don't know if you've seen it. It's the... It's like leadership lessons from a dancing guy. I was just kind of looking it up. I was like, what was that thing called? And it's a guy on a hill. He starts to dance. But is he the leader? Or is the next person that joins in and start, like, that's the person that's actually starting the movement, right? And now the whole mountain of people are dancing, you know? And it's kind of like trying to figure out, like, who really started this? And so I think we're... In the example you gave, you know, we're talking about this one young lady on the cobblestones, but I'm wondering if the person we really should be recognizing is, you know, Dirk, the guy that followed her there or something.
Right. Right. Mike, this feels like early improv following the follower classes.
It does kind of. Yeah.
Right. Where you know, someone initiates and then, you move along and then you don't know who's initiating and who's following.
Right, right. Yeah, when you get to that point, there's that synchronicity with each other. Yeah. Yeah.
So contemporary theories tended towards the metaphysical. People feared the plague was a punishment from Saint Vitus, and to be free of sin, many joined in on the dancing epidemic as sort of a cleansing act, you know, a penitent act. Those who were danced were ordered to go to the shrine of Saint Vitus, who is believed to punish sinners by compelling them to dance uncontrollably. They were made to wear red shoes that were sprinkled with holy water and had crosses painted on the tops and soles. Apparently, this actually worked, and the city was declared forgiven by Vitus, and the dancing plague ended in September.
Wow.
Modern theories tend to be a little less out there. When looking at weird behavior in the Middle Ages, it's never too long before our old friend ergot pops up. Does anyone know what ergot is?
Not sure. No.
Ergot is a fungus that grows on rye and related plants and produces alkaloids that are structurally related to the lysergic acid dimethylide, aka LSD.
Yep.
The fungus has been implicated in other major historical anomalies. People would have weird hallucinations of the apocalypse. And also there was something called the burning plague where people felt like their extremities were burning and it was all caused by ergot.
So a lot of bad trips.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Incidentally, the last big ergot poisoning report took place in France in 1951.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Hundreds of people, as the kids say, tripped balls off of infected bread, with 300 people being sent to the hospital.
Oh my God.
But at least by then they've been like, well, this could be shrooms. This could be LSD. Absolutely. This could be the at least.
In 1951 in rural France.
Oh, rural France. Oh, rural.
Yeah.
Right.
Absinthe maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, so one question. Is there a connection with religion and this kind of mass hysteria that is that you're talking about? I mean,
well, I think it's contextual, right? Where the people in Strasbourg knew about Saint Vitus, who was, you know, sort of an avenging saint who was known for punishing people through dance, and so, you know, that's the context in which it takes place. Someone, I don't know, with a guilty conscience who feels they need to purge themselves of sin.
But what is there any relation to, and I don't know too much about this, but speaking in tongues, and how that can be a kind of contagion that starts and then, you know, it builds into a whole.
Yeah. Speaking in tongues, the scientific name is glossolalia, and it operates in a lot of the same ways where, you know, if one person starts doing it, other people around them will start doing it. And the context is religious, but it's not just limited to Pentecost. That's where it's seen most in the West. But civilizations all over the world have these moments of glossolalia, as it's called, where they, you know, it's like a trance state, or they're communing with the spirit world, or a lot of times it was thought that it was sort of the primal original language. But that's all the context for this sort of physical, you know, episode.
Not to be confused, of course, with like women's cycles syncing up, which is a thing.
Right.
Feels like what?
No. No, I wasn't twisting my head at that because I went to college, so.
Right. We had co-ed floors.
Right.
Ooh.
No, because I don't think that's.
I know you didn't.
No, I'm thinking about this now. If you have four women in four, say, four separate apartments or four different bedrooms, you know, what is the level of association that causes the synchronicity? But that seems like it's much more of a something, you know, you could point to like some sort of chemical operation.
There's got to be a science to that one because it happens, right?
Right.
But I don't want to necessarily poo-poo the science of speaking in tongues as a collective. I don't know. For all I know, it's something that is influenced, you know, by.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, an example of what we were just talking about. Our next example is the Tanganyika laughter epidemic of 1962. And it was an outbreak of mass hysteria that occurred in the village of Kinshasa on the western coast of Lake Victoria in Tanganyika. So the symptoms of the laughter epidemic included laughter, obviously, and crying, as well as general restlessness and pain, as well as fainting, respiratory problems, and rashes. And this is where it gets a little weird, because this description fits almost any modern-day description of mass hysteria events. And they almost all take place at schools, especially in former colonial outposts. So like boarding schools, especially girls' boarding schools, are stricken almost exclusively with things like this.
Hey, Mary, do you remember, excuse me, Michael and Phil, for just a moment. Did you ever do this at sleepovers when you had girlfriends over for sleepovers? We would do a thing where like we would all lay down on the floor and like your head would be on someone else's belly. And it was called ha. And you'd say ha. And then the next person would go ha ha. Ha ha.
Sure, yes.
Right? And by like the fourth, fifth person, you guys are like crying. You're laughing so hard. Like it almost was a perpetuating, almost like, you know, Tasha's hideous laughter from the fifth edition, right? Like is what we're talking about.
There's a kind of emotional quality to this. I'm thinking also about the whole idea of hysteria. And have you ever heard of Charcot, who with Freud, he hypnotized people and they became, you know, absolutely hysterical. So one of their limbs would be completely numb, or they would collapse or faint or whatever. And at the end of the 19th century, it was all the rage to have all these women fainting and in all these kinds of compromised positions. And so hysteria, which comes, as you know, from the word womb, is all connected with this this kind of strange symptomology. And that's what you're talking about, a kind of symptomology, right?
Yeah, and this occurred all over missionary schools in Africa in the 60s. As, you know, sort of the British Empire wound down and other colonial empires wound down in the 60s and 70s, you know, there were these schools there and these kids were caught between these two factors of sort of a very traditional cultural society plus the pressures of a very Western-esque kind of school system with no resources. You know, in the case of this particular epidemic, Tanganyikan society was ruled by very strict traditional elders. And so the likelihood is that the hysteria was a manifestation of the cultural dissonance between the conservatism they saw at home and the new ideas challenging those beliefs in school. And then you mash those together with a group of teenagers who didn't really have the kind of coping skills to deal with this sort of, you know, East meets West, colonizers meets colonized kind of crucible. And then, you know, adolescence and the need, have a need for acceptance. And so you just put that all into a blender and it it makes these kids especially vulnerable to contagion like this.
Interesting.
But it's not a bacterial contagion. You know, it's
psychological contagion.
Yeah. And it, I think, you know, the interesting thing about it is this, is this psychological contagion, right? Is this idea that, you know, you can see something or be a part of a group and that somehow gets inside of you. Aside from Heather's game of Ha, anyone been part of something like this? Have you been swept up in mass hysteria?
I can't really think of a time that I have been, because...
At a concert, does that count?
Oh, okay.
Oh, mass, does that count?
Well, yeah, if that counts. I remember... I remember seeing The Who at the Hollywood Bowl, and they were doing Love Rain Over Me, which is one of my favorites. And let's just say the shrooms kicked in, and it seemed like, and the whole stage went purple, and like everybody, I could just hear everybody going, oh, so maybe there was something to that, or, you know, I don't know, but maybe.
I remember screaming my head off. I think Animotion came and visited my middle school.
You know,
and they were like, "You're my obsession," and all the girls were like,
"You know, I'm thinking about going to this demonstration tomorrow. I've been to a couple in the past, and you know, chanting is always a big part of it. And something like that always has the opposite effect on me. It makes me want to walk out of step. And so, this mechanism seems to take place much below the conscious level." It's not like someone is feeling stressed out and they, you know, decide to start laughing or they're just going to sort of let it out.
But don't you think, you know, Beatlemania is an example of that kind of thing. I remember when I was, I don't know, I was in, I remember it was a long time ago, but Bobby Kennedy came to Albany and I ripped off his, coat pockets off. It was the kind of
amazing.
I know, and he was so cute, and not like his son, as a matter of fact. I think that the whole, you know, rock and roll and all that kind of thing. I mean, Elvis, the hysteria over Elvis,
those hips.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on now to some delusions. This next one hits close to home for me. It's the Great Seattle Windshield Pitting Epidemic. This was a phenomenon that affected swaths of the state, including Bellingham, where I live, Seattle, and other communities in Washington in 1954. This epidemic was characterized by widespread observation of unexplained windshield holes, pits, and dings on previously pristine glass. Originally, it was thought to be the work of vandals, and then the rate of pitting was so ubiquitous across western Puget Sound that residents were convinced there had to be a common and a sinister cause. So you see, the difference here is that there's an actual physical thing happening outside of people's heads.
Okay.
There's no psychological contagion. There's an unexplained physical phenomenon.
Okay.
And I think that what happens with the psychology then is that people will then attribute meaning to that rather than just sort of going bonkers, even if that meaning is somehow insane. You know, it's very much like, you know, any kind of conspiracy.
Or a UFO kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. It might be
something about that. Yeah.
You know, it might be weird. It might be highly improbable, but it's better than not knowing.
Is it also related to like, what was that what was like the bridge monster, like the bat monster? What was that thing?
Mothman?
Mothman. Was it like, is it like Mothman? Is it like one of those kind of sightings that people, multiple people have had, the whole chupacabra type of deal? Is that related to that at all?
I mean, it could be. You know, I think the difference is that chupacabras, the phenomenon is not the chupacabra. That's the explanation for the phenomenon.
Mm.
And that's where the delusion comes in.
Mm.
Right? So with this, in April of 54 in Bellingham, people started waking up to their windshields full of chips and dings and divots and pits. And, you know, when they went to sleep, it was fine. Tangentially, the plague spread to the nearby cities of Cedro Woolley, Mount Vernon, and Anacortes. And within a week, the so-called pitting epidemic had reached metropolitan Seattle. Newspapers start to run with a story, and then more and more reports of pitting were called in, and then motorists began to call in stuff to the police to report damage. Some people thought that a new million-watt radio transmitter was producing waves that caused physical oscillations in the glass. Some people thought it to be the work of cosmic rays. Some people reported seeing glass bubbles form right in front of their eyes, believing it to be the work of sand fleas. By April 15th, close to 3,000 windshields had been reported as effective. It got big enough that the governor requested federal assistance. And by April 17th, the pitting suddenly stopped.
Oh.
Panel theories?
Isn't there like a big Sahara storm on its way to Florida right now? Like something that's literally about to cross the ocean. I mean, surely that wouldn't that happen on the other side too? Like, you know what I mean? It sounds like a sandstorm, no?
I don't know. It seems like, you know, it's pretty limited. No one mentioned a sandstorm happening.
Yeah. What was that creature that they found in the lake in Scotland? The monster, the
Loch Ness monster?
Yeah. I mean, that, you know, I don't know whether it's that a kind of example of what you're talking about.
Did they find Loch Ness or was it a whale penis? I'm saying, well, Google whale penises and you're going to see Loch Ness.
Yeah, no, I've seen those. And yeah, it, you know, there's, right, because they look just like sea serpents. It's crazy.
Yeah. And they breach, right?
Right. Now, here's the thing, though, is that people had these physical things, right? They went to sleep and their windshield looked one way. They got up and looked another way. This is not, you know, this is not something that they didn't prove was happening. It was what was causing it that was the mystery. And the way it worked is that people came up with these theories to explain this phenomenon. But no one really knows what was happening. The prevailing theory is that there was some weird window pitting going on, a very little bit, but mostly it was vandalism and basically the power of suggestion is that maybe, you know, your windshield isn't that pitted, but once it's in the context of everyone going out there and looking at their windshields every morning, suddenly everything becomes noticeable.
Well, we love to fill in spaces with theories, and yeah. I think we love to fill in, you know, things that are happening. I know, you know, that are mysteries or that something makes us uncomfortable. And so it's filling in the answers.
Much like our eye fills in the visual, right?
Right. Exactly. I remember when, and I think you know this, Phil, I was walking. I have a thing about snakes. I have a phobia. And I was walking across a bridge, with my brother and my husband, and, coming towards me, which I didn't know, was a giant, boa constrictor.
It was a guy was walking down the street and he had, you know, he was like a muscle shirt guy and he had like a boa constrictor, you know, around his shoulders.
Oh, okay.
Oh. Appreciate the context. Okay, got it.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, and
so not only was it not an unaccompanied snake, but it was a snake up at shoulder level.
And it went right by me. I didn't see it.
Really?
And that's the kind, it's called blind hysteria. So I think our perceptions, you know, it's almost like body dysphoria, you know, it's that kind of blindness or perception or distortion or whatever that we never see the real.
Yeah, and I think we find the explanations that we want to find. You know, if people don't trust the government, then sure, then some secret government conspiracy is pitting the windshields.
Yeah, right.
Well, I saw that Trump has a catheter on his leg. Did you anybody see that one?
Is this a conspiracy theory?
I did not. What?
Oh, wasn't that interesting, Mike?
Yeah, that was interesting. They had a whole like drawing of how it's strapped to his leg, and there's a bladder on the bottom and everything. And yeah,
right. Yeah, and you saw his pant leg.
Yeah,
with this box and with this, you know, strap going down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I guess liberals will then say this is like a diaper system, and conservatives will say it's, you know, I don't know, some kind of secret space laser or
exactly
what makes them bulletproof.
It's holy water to them. Yeah.
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 Does anyone remember?
I'm sorry, I'm Googling Trump and catheter. Hold on just one second.
Oh, well, enjoy your algorithm going forward.
One thing about that really quick. There is a guy who used to work on the show The Apprentice. I forget his name, but I've heard him on some podcasts and everything, who talked about the fact that Donald Trump was addicted to Adderall and he would wear diapers and he had to be cleaned up every once in a while.
This is all staying in the final edit, by the way.
Yeah, oh, and they talk about his odorous qualities too.
Oh yeah,
did you find the catheter?
Yeah, he's supposed to stink.
Oh yeah, you can't avoid it once you ask for information. Yeah. Oh my gosh!
Anyone remember the weird, scary clown sightings from about 10 years ago?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyone know what that was about?
No, but that was such an interesting phenomenon because I have students in my classes who said that they were part of that.
So in August 2016, beginning in Green Bay, Wisconsin, reports began to surface of people dressed as scary clowns lurking in incongruous places and times. After this Wisconsin incident, numerous other clown sightings started popping up across the United States and around the world. In late August, a clown was sighted in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, offering treats to children. The clown fled when police arrived. In early October, scary clown sightings were reported in Canada, the United Kingdom, and Australia. British communities were described as horrified.
Hmm.
I assume in a very British way. They were not chuffed. After much media and internet speculations, suspicions of the clowns being related to a horror film were confirmed when a Wisconsin filmmaker announced the pictures were a marketing stunt for a then-unreleased short film titled Gags. A feature film was produced based on the short film and premiered in 2018.
Uh-huh.
So here's where it gets interesting, because even though an explanation for this came forward within months, the genie was solidly out of the bottle. People were freaked the fuck out, and they didn't want to hear that their fears were baseless. The social media rumor mill went to overdrive. These culminated with several news outlets reporting on an alleged clown-initiated purge, which supposedly was to take place on Halloween of 2016, where the clowns were going to come for us all. Spoiler, they did not.
What?
But once this thing got started, people fed into it, right? People started putting on clown costumes because they thought it was funny and whatever. But also, people decided that any explanation was not the real explanation. It seems to be a case of people actively rejecting demonstrably true facts in favor of a patently outlandish theory.
Well, that's like the whale penis.
That was good. That's like the Republican Party.
Well, but this is like the plague of our days. What is it all about? What is it about the unbelievable that makes it more acceptable than the truth?
Well, I think the one thing that you had mentioned about how people want to not feel like they've been duped. And I think a lot of people, instead of just being able to accept the reality of something, would rather, it makes them feel more comfortable thinking that it's something outlandish or sinister or something like that.
There's also that desire to have a bad object. I think with Hillary Clinton, for instance, that she was trafficking in, child pornography.
Oh, the Pizzagate thing? Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. Right.
And you always want a villain? You always want to villainize something, you mean?
Yes, but also, don't you think it's part of the tabloid culture, too? That, it's the tabloization of American culture, too. I mean, you get those things from at the supermarket that become more ridiculous, but I think they became that way with Jerry Springer and that whole.
Well, also the 20.
There was always the Weekly World News. There was always the National Enquirer.
Then you had the 24-hour news cycle, and then you had social media in like 2016. I mean, isn't it like a dopamine rush? Like it's just stimulating to kind of be
yeah.
I think what the difference is, though, is that we've always had that kind of thing in whatever form it takes, whatever the media is of the day, whether it's print or television, whether it's the Weekly World News or Jerry Springer. The difference, I think, though, is that there is an erosion of traditional institutions of facts, right? We always had the Weekly World News. We always had Jerry Springer, but they were certainly not set up to be on the same level of credibility as the New York Times or 60 Minutes. And now, as I think a result of social media and the internet, every voice is equally loud, no matter what they're saying. And so there's, no one has to say, well, I want to believe this, but this expert says that, so I should go with the expert. In fact, it feeds the opposite. Oh, the expert says this? Well, that means I should believe the opposite because they're all in on the grand conspiracy.
But isn't it easier to be gullible than it is to be educated, right? Isn't it easier to be mean than it is to be kind? You know what I mean? I wonder if there's something there of like just the release of any critical thinking.
Yeah.
Is its own stimulation.
I also think there's the whole thing about virality. And by that, I mean the viral. Things go viral all the time. And I'm just trying to think of some examples where things go viral, now everything does. And the whole culture is sort of viral since COVID and during COVID. And, it's literally.
And every subgroup has their own set of, of narratives and viral things. And these things have real world consequences. So, for example, in the case of the 2016 clown epidemic, Target pulled all clown costumes from their shelves. McDonald's decided that Ronald McDonald would keep a lower profile and change their entire advertising campaign. Schools worldwide issued clown bans for any Halloween events. Basically, all clown-related businesses, from circuses to restaurants to costume stores, were hit. One sociologist called 2016 a bad time to be a professional clown. This hysteria peaked with mobs initiating clown hunts at two different universities in Florida.
Wow.
Florida.
Well, yeah.
So, panel, I ask you, do you like clowns? Are they ever funny?
When you're five. I think
they're incredibly scary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. No, it's like they're designed to be scary. What were you going to say, Mike?
Oh, I was just going to say, I think when I was like 5 or 6 years old, I think that I thought some of the things that they did were funny. But I know pretty soon after that, it started just being freaky and weird and scary.
Well, but like slapstick is funny, but clowns, like dealing with an individual clown is just unnerving.
Yeah.
Well, and then there's Stephen King. Right? It.
With It? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was scary because it fed into the fear that already existed, much like Poltergeist had the clown under the bed. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like the was it Donner or Spielberg produced it, right?
That was Spielberg.
The reason why that movie was so fucking scary is that they just remembered every little fear you had. And somehow in that movie.
Yeah, the closet door. The tree outside, the clown, the thing under the bed.
The unfinished pool.
The unfinished pool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
it was a scary movie.
On that eerie note, we come to the end of round two, and we've got some more scores. So Heather remains in the lead with 27, with Mike nipping at her heels with 23, sweet, and Mary coming up behind in third place with 21 points.
Oh, thanks.
Try harder. We're going to finish up with round three, and we're going to finish up here with some mass hoaxes. Neither delusion nor hysteria, but could be the cause of either one. The first of these is probably one of the best coordinated hoaxes of all time. We take you to the peaceful village of Gotham, not the Batman one, in England in the year 1200. The king at the time, John, he of Robin Hood and Magna Carta, for you keeping score.
And George Washington.
I'm sorry?
George Washington was a descendant of Prince John.
Really?
Yes.
Well, there you go.
I learned that from a poster.
See, we don't need teachers. We just need posters.
That's right.
So John, the king, decided he wanted to visit Nottingham. And the road that would get him there ran right through the village of Gotham, not the Batman one. This route meant that the road the court traveled on would become a king's highway and therefore would become liable to much higher taxes. The villagers of Gotham did not like this. So when the king's advance people arrived, the whole village pretended to be insane. Madness was considered a contagious illness back then. And when King John learned of this infested little town, he decided on a different route.
Wow.
And this is like, smart, you know, this is not people pretending to have like, schizoid disorder or...
This is anthrax, you know, from like this is close ranting encounters, and raving, right?
Yeah, but, you know, it's like...
like a ranting and raving kind of a thing? Where
Yeah. You know, ask your average fifth grader to act crazy, and that's what I picture. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of pants on heads, or...
Is that what they're doing?
That's what I assume in my mind.
or they're sitting on Elon's head.
Right. It seems pretty easy to disprove, though. I mean, just like wait a couple hours and go back to the town.
Yeah, right.
Have you, panel, I'll go to each one of you, have you ever pretended to be insane in order to get out of anything? Or pretended to be, and not just canceling plans, but what lengths have you gone to get out of something?
Ooh, that's a different question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ooh, I got one. Okay, when I was a sophomore in high school, I happened to contract mono and hepatitis, right? Let's just say I didn't feel bad for as long as I was out of school. I decided I could do school for this entire semester independently. And I would literally stay in bed until people like left for work, and I would get out of bed and like karaoke in my room. And I did just fine in school. But I didn't want to go to school that semester. It was just, yeah.
Okay.
So yep.
Mary, how about you?
I would throw up all the time. And then I wouldn't have to go to school. And I grow up in my mother's car.
We'll sing a theme.
Right. Exactly here. And I also remember you, doing the same thing, with school, not wanting to go to school. Yeah.
Okay. Mike, how about you? In school doesn't count.
Oh, okay. Well, I know that I had this one job a while back that I really didn't like, and I threw my back out, and it took me several days just to even get out of bed.
You know, I have to say these are all very disappointingly plausible schemes.
Oh,
I will, you know, just to shame you all, I will relate the story of a girl I used to go out with in Chicago, who worked at a bakery. And so she had to get up really, really early for work. And, 3:30 to get there at 4 to start baking bread. And I was there and witnessed a phone call where she called into work blind.
Blind?
Yep. She said she woke up and she was blind.
Wow.
Couldn't see a thing, but she'll probably be in tomorrow. She'd be all cleared up by then.
It's a 24-hour blindness.
We did have someone in our singing group in college. I don't know if you remember her, Phil, but Jen. And Jen always—
You've got to be more specific than Jen. Every fourth girl at school was named Jen.
Well, I mean, we're on a podcast, right? Okay, so Jen, I just remember that every rehearsal she was late and there was excuses after excuses. And maybe that's a little different than what we're talking about, but it did range from like, I hit a skunk. And I was late because I hit a skunk and I needed to wash the car. And you're just like, what are you talking about? I mean, but it became an ongoing, you know,
thing.
Yeah.
So we're going to finish up with my personal favorite hoax because of the weird synchronicity to it. On May 29th, 1947, the Armed Forces radio station in Tokyo interrupted its evening broadcast of dance music with a disturbing news bulletin. A 20-foot sea monster had emerged from the waters of Tokyo Bay and was making its way inland. The entire region was said to have been thrown into chaos. For the next hour, a series of bulletins updated listeners on the progress of the dragon as it proceeded downtown, derailing trains and smashing buildings. Troops were said to be battling it, although bullets were useless against it. So instead, soldiers were using flamethrowers, grenades, tear gas, and phosphorus bombs. Listeners were advised to barricade themselves indoors and to keep phone lines clear for emergency calls. One listener later recalled that the reports, quote, continued at a frantic pace, including harrowing rescues and escapes, remote radio links, movements of heavy weapons and tanks, and all this stuff of which the truly epic stories are made. Accompanied by the terrifying screams, roars, and shrieks of both the beast and the panic-stricken populace, as well as the gunfire and bullhorns of the protectors.
Wow.
Yeah.
Why didn't they just get Mothra to help out, you know?
So, what do you think's going on?
I mean, this is War of the Worlds.
Kaiju phobia?
Yeah. Right, except this is like a year and a half after the end of World War II. Japan has been leveled and nuked twice.
I was gonna say, do you think maybe it's because of the nuclear bombs going off and the radiation maybe getting in? You know, thinking that, well, if there's radiation on land and people died from the radiation, maybe it got into the water too and created some sort of, you know, kaiju thing or something like that. But is that a possibility there?
So when the monster reached downtown Tokyo, an announcer told listeners that he would, quote, draw near the beast, unquote. He did so, at which point the monster stopped, turned and addressed the listeners in a soprano voice. It said that it wished to congratulate the Armed Forces radio station on its fifth anniversary.
So this is their version of Orson Welles doing War of the Worlds on the radio.
Right, exactly.
Right,
my grandma Rose shoved— I think we talked about this in the last show, Phil. My grandma Rose shoved towels under the door in New York because of the Martian gases that were supposedly about to come through the door.
Wow.
You know, this— yeah, I feel like this is not the time to do a big, like, your city's about to be destroyed practical joke. During the program, the station personnel declined to respond to requests for more information. As soon as the program ended, it was revealed to be a joke, and listeners were asked to stop telephoning the radio station, Army headquarters, or the police. These explanations continued until the station went off the air that night, but alarmed queries were being received as late as 14 hours later.
Wow.
Among those who called was an officer from the British occupation troops who said his men were demanding rifles and grenades so that they could join the battle. One GI telephoned to say that he personally had seen the monster, which he described as horrifying, thick-skinned, and grinning in an oily and slimy manner.
Hmm.
Wow. People did not think this was funny.
He had ergot.
the Japanese people nor the military authorities were pleased by the broadcast.
Sure.
Soon after the program ended, counterintelligence officers arrived at the station and informed the officer in charge that there, quote, there'll be repercussions. And a number of these men were reportedly later transferred to Korea. So apparently this is just something they thought up and did. This wasn't like a series of meetings that were okayed.
Couple guys got together, drank some sake, and went, oh, we should do this? Yeah.
It reminds me of, do you remember Balloon Boy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
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 From Bigfoot. Bigfoot.
Well, but that's not a sort of boy who cried wolf, right? I mean, people are saying ostensibly that, no, this thing exists.
Right.
Right. As opposed to, you know, a prank or a hoax or just a straight up lie.
Yeah.
It's the weird synchronicity with Godzilla.
Yeah.
That's so strange, which yeah. wouldn't be released for another 7 years.
Huh?
Mm. Yeah, but again, circling back to things that are already in the universe and the ethos and like what it's already like sparking either fears or thoughts, maybe it takes 7 years to see the results of those things kind of manifest themselves.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Thanks, Phil.
You know, well, so Godzilla was based certainly on the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings, but also on the Castle Bravo nuclear test that had just taken place a year before and had introduced a lot of radiation sickness to the area.
Mm-hmm. Well,
apparently the bombs that are hitting Israel right now are also producing a lot of radioactive junk.
Oh, right. You mean even that the missile defense shield can't?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I just heard that.
I got a stepbrother who's living there. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, this is certainly the most Hebraic panel we've had on. Can't believe you're all doing this.
Yeah.
All doing this on the Sabbath.
The
ashamed of
on
yourselves.
The Sabbath.
Oh, my God.
I was expecting everyone to show up with Shabbos Goyas to answer their question. This is going to be in the final edit, too. All right, panel, while I tally up the scores, tell me, what hoax would you like to stage? Heather, let's start with you.
Why are you starting with me? I need processing time. All right, hold on. A hoax I want to stage? I don't know, Phil. I was never a pranker. So sorry, I can't play along with that one. I can't, because hoaxes, people do get harmed, right, with hoaxes. And
well, but think of it as mythology.
Think of it like mythology.
You know, or even, you know, throw a rock at the old Henson house, and if you break a window, you make a wish.
Oh, well, I can understand that, I guess. The whole tooth fairy kind of thing is a kind of a hoax, but...
Yeah, or like Ian Fleming in one of the Bond novels pointed out that gay people are not left-handed.
That's so random. That is so random. I mean, if you want to create like something sweet, I would be on board with that. You know, like wishes, right? But I was never like amused by pranks or hoaxes. I never liked being made to feel like I was gullible. You know, that always kind of pissed me off as a kid.
Okay. Well, you heard it here first, folks. Heather Walpert thinks you're gullible. Mike, moving on to you.
I gave him time to think. I just want people to know that.
Right,
okay.
Right. And I think I would like to do some sort of hoax regarding something like gummy bears or something like that. I don't know why this popped into my head, but like, seeing that, you know, if you eat more than a certain amount of gummy bears in one sitting, you're going to have a growth in your stomach or something. I don't know.
The old watermelon seed trick.
Oh, right. Yeah, that kind of a thing. That's where my mind went. So, yeah.
And Mary?
I want to do some kind of hoax about Stephen Miller.
Weird.
And I don't know what that would be, but it would be some kind of belief about him that he's.
You should check out the website Ted Cruz for Human President for inspiration.
Yeah, right. That's great. Yeah.
It's amazing. It really is. Ted Cruz for Human President.
Okay. All right.
I used to have a great time when I was teaching middle school, when we talk about, how do we do literacy, digital literacy and internet literacy. I would always use that. It was Northwestern Tree Octopus website to kind of have them dig into the Photoshopped pictures, because those tree octopi are like really, really endangered. And they really needed to know more about them. So that was always fun.
Something else to look up along those lines, in the 50s, the BBC put out an April Fool's broadcast about the pasta harvest in Italy. It's unbelievable. It's on YouTube. Definitely check it out.
I was thinking that for Stephen Miller, I think the only hoax that you could do with him is to say that he's a decent human being.
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing.
I was just trying to think of, like, oh, that'll be a good one. It's like,
I think he's seven weasels in a human costume.
Oh, there you go.
He was born in Nicaragua.
Show me the birth certificate.
Yeah.
Well, this is an exciting score. At the end of round three, we have a tie. Mary and Heather, you're both tied at 42 points. Mike is our winner with 43 points. The Captain Crunch and Draggy Rights this week belong to you, sir.
I can't wait for that Captain Crunch.
Right. I'm still waiting for mine from last week. I'm just warning you.
Well, it'll be there.
That's
it for this week's Wait What. Congrats to Mike, this week's winner. Wait What was hosted, written, and researched by me, Phil Ahrensberg. I'd like to thank all of my guests, Michael Burson, Heather Wolbert-Garin, and Mary Valentis. Thank you very much, guys. We'll catch you again next time when we once more clutch the dagger of knowledge between our teeth and take another dive into the murky depths of human history, prying the pearl of wisdom from the clam of obscurity. Please do you all the podcast things, comment, share, and talk about it on your socials. Thanks so much, everyone, and good night. Wait What is hosted, written, and researched by me, Phil Ahrensberg. The show is edited by Dern Gleaves, and our music is by Wesley Devine.